Data is interesting, not because of the data itself, but because of what we learn from that data. In this sponsored Packet Pushers Weekly show, we talk about just how to extract meaningful business data from the network in a conversation with Aruba, a Hewlett-Packard Enterprise company. I am Ethan Banks, joined by Greg Farrell in sunny Las Vegas, Nevada, here at the Atmosphere 2016 conference. Speaking with us about how network data is fueling business insights is Kirti Melkote, CTO and co-founder of Aruba. Kirti, welcome to Packet Pushers, and please introduce yourself to the audience.
Thank you, guys. Great to see you. And my name, as you already introduced me, is Kirti Melkote. I started Aruba back in 2002 and been with Aruba ever since, so looking forward to the conversation.
So it's all your fault.
Yeah.
It is. You can blame it all on me.
Okay, so Kirti, I want to start off with kind of a question that's going to come across as rude, although I don't mean it to be, but... Okay, fueling business insights. This was the topic that was given to us today. And the first thing that popped in my head is, that sounds like something Dilbert's boss would say. We're going to fuel business insights. So help us. Okay, this is, I know, a strategic direction that Aruba is going here, you know, insight of data. What does that really mean? Give me some meat here.
Yeah, if you trust the marketing guys, that's the title they come up with.
Yeah.
So let's keep it to the bits and bytes, right? In networking, you know, we've always specialized in pushing packets. That's, you guys call yourself packet pushers. That's what we are, right? We basically get bits over the air or over the wire and push them across on the other side. And that's been the job. And it's a difficult enough job as it is, right? We just to make it work in complex environments and getting the right quality of service delivered, right security delivered on the network. But in more recent conversations that I've been having with CIOs, we talk about data. We talk about the data that's in the network, not data that users use. I mean, we use data, you know, PowerPoint files and Word files and all these kinds of things.
Yep.
But data about the packets, right? Where is it coming from? Where is it going? Who is it coming from?
And we're familiar with these things in the form of NetFlow, for example.
Yes, exactly. NetFlow is a good example of, you know, data about the packets themselves. The question that gets asked is, how can I take this data and apply it for some business use?
Mm-hmm. Right?
That, and I'll give you some examples. We are obviously, we've been in the wireless business a long time, and the world knows we're all going to all mobile, all wireless kind of a world. And that's driving a fundamental change in the real estate of most offices. They're going away from the concept of a workstation. You don't go to work to sit at a workstation. You work wherever you are on your device. If you want to make a call, you don't go to your workstation to your desk phone. You just make a phone call from your mobile device. That's the world today. But why is it that offices are still designed for the 1990s workstation? Right? So a lot of universities don't do that anymore. If you go to Google's campus, Facebook's campus, if you go to any startup in Silicon Valley, they're building open floor plans.
It's not about I'm going to my desk, I'm going to my cube that's got my precious nameplate on it and all that.
Correct.
It's just a different way of thinking. I'm going to this building to get some work done, wherever that happens to be.
That's right. I want to be with my colleagues. I want to be collaborative. I want to brainstorm. I want to come up with new ideas and then go figure out a quiet place to sit and do the coding.
Mm-hmm.
That's the job,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
So why does it require a workstation? It doesn't. You can sit outdoors and work. If it's a great sunny day, you can sit indoors. So the world has changed. The workplace has changed. So we used to have a template for what a workplace looked like. In an open workplace, there is no template. There are personas, right? When you come in the morning, you're going into a meeting, you're a collaborative guy. When you're quiet coding, you want to be at a quiet location somewhere else, right? Mm. So your persona changes throughout the day. And so, I mean, the architects are having a field day when the executives of a company says, hey, I want an open floor plan. They're like, oh, that's great. That's carte blanche to do whatever I want to do, right?
Yeah.
And so there's all these crazy floor plans that we see out there. Yeah. But the key question that comes up from all these real estate facilities people is, how do I measure the success of the workplace that I just put in? And that is basically an insight that they're looking for. So let's say I tore down my floor plan. I created this new open workflow. Is it working for my employees or not? Right? What do I need? What data do I need to analyze that? I need to know where people come in. Where do they sit?
You send out a survey.
Yeah. Worse yet, we used to have people watch us. I don't know if you've seen that in your offices, but you have these quiet guys that you don't recognize that come every once in a while and just take a look
at what's happening. They have a folder and they tick off every desk that in.
Mm-hmm.
And then
That's
we
right.
learned to actually make sure that everybody was sitting in our area or we'd end up with less space.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Exactly.
It's not very...
It is a point in time. Mm. It is not a continuous capture of what's happening, and it is not very scientific.
Mm.
And but if I could tell you where people have been, where they're going, what's the dynamics of location engagement in your office space, that's data coming from the network, especially in the wireless network. We know where we don't have to make it personalized so that we don't violate any privacy issues here.
Okay, you did creep me out for a second there.
Yeah. I don't need to know you are there. I just need to know someone was there. So the space got utilized. Right. And so as I abstract that out and start to look at people moving around and how they congregate and how they work together, I can improve my floor planning, real estate utilization. It's helpful to improve productivity, business productivity of a company.
Mm.
It's also helpful if I can lower my real estate costs. So it goes directly to the bottom line. And this is a business insight that I would have never thought a networking guy would ever be asked for. But it is being asked. These questions are being
physical
asked.
Physical locations within the building.
Physical locations within the building.
Because typically when you think of data mining, network data, where are people going? What are they spending their time doing on the network? Which is still valuable, of course. But
yes.
This is a whole different sort of application.
It is a location-based application.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But that's what networks can do today, especially on the wireless side. Another example back to what you just said, which is, What are people doing on the network? Where are they going? That is very interesting for retailers. If you're a retailer and you use guest access and you're inside a showroom, again, I don't need to know about you in particular, although I'm sure retailers would love that if you give them the option. But I want to know when people are inside my showroom, are they shopping for TVs on Amazon? When I can sell them TVs here? And if they are...
Did they scan the barcode in front of them to see what Amazon's price was?
That's exactly right. I mean, they would love to know that. And so we can facilitate that, right? We can know which showroom you were in. We can know, okay, the showroom in Las Vegas generated the most traffic to Amazon's this TV sale that was happening.
Yeah. Mm.
So I have an opportunity at that point to either drop my prices or send an associate your way and upsell and say, hey, you know that TV that you're looking for? It may be interesting, but I have a better TV that I can sell you. So it goes to real business and makes a difference.
I can see a new IoT category. I can see a little IoT device, which is a sales tag, that gets updated on the fly. So you could come back 10 minutes later and find it.
The price drops.
It's so Minority Report. It really is.
That is the flip side of this, right? Is how do you avoid the privacy concerns that it raises, right? So you got to anonymize all this. First of all, if you don't anonymize it, then you have a problem, right? And so it's aggregate data.
Your first answer is not, well, people have to opt in. Your first answer is, well, we can anonymize this data.
Yes.
That's an interesting perspective.
Yes. And opt-in has to come in when you're actually, by the fact that you're using the network, you have opted in to use the network. You don't have to use the network.
Right? Sure.
So there is an opt-in process right there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the question then becomes, even if you opt in, I don't want, without your explicit permission, to learn about you. It's a liability for me as a company.
You want to know behaviors. You don't want to attack that behavior to an individual human being.
That's right. It's a huge liability as a corporation to take on, right? I don't want to take that on. And so
it's like holding credit card data. You don't want to hold the credit card data for fear of losing it.
Correct.
Well, wait a minute, though. Right. This is a different perspective than what we usually hear, though, because usually we hear, no, we want to know exactly who you are so we can market explicitly to you. And what you're saying is, no, actually, we don't want that legally. That's a problem.
Yeah. I think especially in the marketing area, that's a problem. User experience is a different story.
Mm.
If you want to create a user experience, you want to personalize it.
You've got to keep customer data. Right. So if you sign up and buy a TV and register for a 5-year warranty or whatever it is, you need your name and address as part of the legal contract.
Mm. I'll tell you a personalized experience. Mm. We talked about hospitality, right? So if you're a loyal user in a hotel, right, or a hotel chain, right, I want my experience to be personalized. So I want the hotel property owner to know that I just walked in. I don't want to stand in line to get my room key. I want to be pushed a notification that says, welcome, Kirti. This is your
follow
room.
Follow the blue dot to this place here, which is the special.
Follow the blue dot to your room and off you go, right? Yeah. It's a hassle to stand in front of a line to get my card and,
show your ID and give all that stuff, right?
Especially if I'm a loyal member and I'm a frequent traveler, I want to avoid
that. If you meet some sort of policy, your credit card is on file, you're a registered member of a special group, why are you checking in?
Exactly.
You know, they've got a room ready for you. It's...
Yeah, and you're a trusted member, you're earning whatever frequent flyer miles that you get from it, et cetera. So then once I go in, I don't mind if they learn about my taste in music and play the music that I want in the hotel room. I don't mind if they illuminate the room when I walk in, walk out.
Set the tent to whatever you want. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a case where I do want to learn about
you. It's uncanny valley, I think.
Yeah.
Part of us has got it is that we need as a society or as a group to move through these phases of acceptance. You know, there's denial and then there's acceptance sort of thing.
And there's a generational thing too. We perhaps belong to a generation that finds it difficult, but there's another generation that's like totally
But you're
fine.
Aware of that as a CTO of Aruba. You're not ignorant to these concerns.
No, not at all. They're top of mind. They're important, right? I mean, how could you ignore it?
And again, anonymizing data is possible and desirable in certain circumstances.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is. It's a button. In fact, if we offer that in our analytics platform, you can just click one button and say anonymize, and it's you never see anything about a user.
Mm-hmm.
It's all aggregate.
So, okay, I'm an Aruba customer. I'm interested in gaining business insights of whatever it is. Does Aruba help me to ask the right questions? And here's what I mean. There's data, you can stare at graphs all day long, numbers and pie charts and whatever, and that's okay, but it doesn't really tell you much. How do you ask the right question to get useful data back out of the data set?
That's a very good question. That's not an obvious question to ask. Right now, to be honest, we are mostly trying to answer the questions that are asked of us. Real estate utilization is an example of that, or shopping patterns online is so people, the business folks especially, have a very specific question that they want to answer. Translating that into a specific question that you need to ask of the data that's ahead, that's the piece that we can actually help in, right? Here is the fields that you want to be looking for, and here is the query. So if you take a question,
I need to figure out X. Okay, here's what you ask of the data to help you figure out
that's
X.
Right. Yeah, I call that a query as opposed to a question, right? The question is the business abstract question.
Mm-hmm.
We don't create those questions. The business owners create those questions. We take that, translate into a query to specific information that's there in the data to extract that and present that to you.
What tool am I interacting with here?
It's basically a database, right? I mean, we're collecting a lot of data and storing it for great lengths of time. It's a big data project. So we end up taking information about users, devices, packets, IP addresses, destinations, sources, applications, et cetera,
and there's got to be history to it.
And I mean, fundamentally, you need lots of data to be able to make any sense of it from a trending perspective, which is what people are looking for the
so
most
part. So
that's
a machine learning exercise.
Yeah.
You have to be parsing it through the machine learning algorithms.
You have to. So that is when you ask, I mean, going back to your question, that's a very important and interesting question, is if I already know the question, then I do my query, I can extract the features that you want and present it to you. But there's another aspect to big data learning, which is sometimes you don't know what you want to look for in the data. There's a lot of data out there. Can the machines go out and extract features that are interesting to me? And that is an evolving field. That is what we call deep learning, where I don't know what the trends are. And you know, I'll give you another example of deep learning. There was a question that a CIO at a university asked me about, can network traffic give me an idea of student retention? And you know, my job as a university, when I admit a student, is to graduate them in 4 years successfully.
Or to make sure they stay the 4 years so you extract the revenue from them.
Of course, that too.
Was I being a bit blunt?
Such a mercenary.
Are you a graduate?
No.
You're not? Okay,
no.
There you go.
It's a long story. It's a long story. I have a good excuse.
No, you don't need to apologize. It's fine. You're doing great. We have some great folks without... Bill Gates dropped out, so it's fine. Mark Zuckerberg dropped out, it's fine. But that's a question that CIOs have asked. And I didn't know the answer to that question, right? So there may be information in there, but I don't know if there's information that in the network data that can answer that question, but a deep learning algorithm can try to figure that out. And while we were having this conversation, Meg Whitman was with me in this particular meeting, and she said, hey, I'm on the board of a school that serves underprivileged kids. It is in an economically depressed area, and one of the key metrics that they measure is how many high schoolers actually go into university and graduate, which means they're doing their good job in high school. And one of the learnings that they found through analytics was that the predictor of graduation after 4 years for a student from that school, especially first-generation folks that go to school, is distance from the home. The further away from the home you are, the higher likelihood that you're going to not graduate. And that's like, I had no idea that was going to be the case. I mean, until somebody told me that. And
you wouldn't make that query unless somebody asked that question.
Yeah.
But why would you think to correlate distance from school to graduation rates?
Correct.
So
the answer came out like that, right? And the question was just student retention rates. I didn't ask the data saying, is it related to distance? I'm not smart enough for that. I'm just asking the big question. The data is telling me it's related, correlated to distance. So data analysis algorithms, that is what data analysis is about, is picking out the patterns and the featurettes and the correlations that then give you these insights that you didn't have before.
But you need enough data to feed the algorithms.
That's right.
And so you need, and not just data, but metadata as well. So you need context. So as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that you need to be able to collect every packet or flow data as it comes through. But what you would then need is metadata about who owned the flow. Yes. And then you need metadata to say, what is that flow made of? What is the application? What is the time? What is the context of what was happening in the network or around? What is the application?
Correct.
You can't just
What's the location, for example? Where did it come from?
Yeah, the geolocation data, you know.
Exactly. That's absolutely. So you're taking the packet itself, which NetFlow does, but then you all need all this context as well.
You need metadata and context.
Yeah. And I'm not advocating that you store every packet. That's interesting for security forensics. If you want to go figure out what attack happened and so on, security insights, storing lots of packets over a large period of time is interesting. But sometimes you don't need to store the packet. You just need to store the metadata around the packet.
So from a Ruba infrastructure perspective, how am I gathering this data? I've got access points. I've got some switches maybe. I've got, is there an analysis tool that I'm buying that is going to help me do this?
Yeah. So what we end up doing, the system itself, Aruba access points, Aruba controllers, Aruba switches, it is fundamentally set up to capture this metadata about user, device, location, application, and so on. It gets normalized and stored in a database called Analytics and Location Engine. Okay. And then that Analytics and Location Engine then gives you access to query data over a long period of time.
I've bought either VM or an appliance, and I've set up how data retention, how long I want to hold on to that data. Yeah. And now I've got, and then there's a query engine, so I can ask all of this data that's been normalized.
That's right.
Questions.
That's right.
Okay.
It's a RESTful API. You can ask any questions that you want, and you can publish and subscribe to events, new events that are happening on this engine as well. So if there's new metadata that we generate, then you can say, I want to subscribe to that feed, or I may not want to subscribe to that feed. And the idea of that is this user information, right? If you anonymize it, I am never going to subscribe to the user feed, right? And I'm not even going to give you the user feed. It's going to just be dropped out of the database. You'll never get any information about the user.
Now, is this only a local application, or is some of this, is there a cloud flavor of this that maybe aggregates global trends?
There is a cloud flavor of this. It's something we're building. It's not in production yet. What customers have done is take the data and build their own analytics tools on top to do the queries, to answer the questions that they want. But I think we have found enough use cases for building products around it. One use case that we're going to build is around network insights. I talked about the biggest thing that customers, networking folks, want to measure is user experience. How is the user experience trending? What are the biggest variables in ensuring a good user experience?
In other words, it's not enough to know I've got good Wi-Fi strength. I need to know when someone is using an app across this access point, what is it really like for them?
Correct.
And all the different pieces and parts that go along with transaction, right. DNS and web, and whatever it might be.
That's exactly right. And collecting that information and then presenting it in a way that correlates back to user experience is the most important thing. And you know, the thing I heard about user experience is when we say something here, we have listeners out there listening. It's from my mouth to their ear. There's a bunch of things that happen in between. What's the fidelity of that particular conversation?
And the reliability of the chain.
And the reliability of the chain. All the pieces matter.
Yep.
And you want insight into how things are trending so people, so networking folks can fix the problem before it actually happens.
Yeah, because people say the Wi-Fi is broken. Is it the DHCP server? Is it the SSID? Is the spectrum overloaded? Is it DNS lookup? Is the internet connection overloaded? Whatever it is.
That's right.
I want to talk a bit about the mechanics of collecting metadata. And I think it's important in terms of Aruba's product portfolio because the access points and the switches actually recognize users. And they, you know, the Aruba OS that runs on the APs and the switches talks to the Airwave and the ClearPass. And the ClearPass is the authentication engine that allows you to register users. So for the first time, perhaps ever in the history of networking, we're actually able to collect that metadata and build that analytics data. And you can get it from mobile phone, from a tablet, from a laptop, from a desktop, from a printer, from a – it's all bound into one unified system. And I can take metadata from ClearPass and Airwave and from the devices and then funnel them all into the analytics engine.
That's correct.
To get those insights.
That's correct. And it was all triggered by this idea that, you know, before I let you connect into the network, prove to me who you are. And that was necessary to do in Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
And instead of just using that data and throwing it away, saying, okay, I know who you are now. Thank you very much. I'll just push your packets. We basically said, hey, this is interesting information. We'll keep it. And that's when we started to collect the data and said, okay, this was a laptop. Now an iPad came onto the network or an iPhone came onto the network. That's interesting data. We'll collect that data. Mm-hmm. Applications, we'll collect that data. That's how we started to build out this metadata framework. And location is another one of those things, right, where as you move around a facility, we can figure out what quadrant you're in, what zone you're in, and feed that back into the engine as well. So it's a continuous collection engine that happens.
Yeah.
It's not stored in the network. It's stored in this analytics engine. But the collection, the instrumentation is something we've had to build into Aruba OS, as you said.
Yeah, it's not something inside. We could have done 10 years ago or 5 years ago or, you know, even 3 or 4. You know.
It's hard to do on wired networks today because people don't authenticate. And this is one of the biggest problems with IoT. Probably the biggest security problem in our age is you take a wired port, you plug in a device, it's going to get an IP address, and you can start to ping any device on the network.
But there's no user context to wrap around that session.
You have no idea. You just give someone connection to your network just because they're in the building and have access to the port. That kind of security posture is not acceptable anymore. And that's where the risks lie for the most part, right? All the credit card transactions getting compromised. It was a point of sale device that's on the network that got compromised because somebody accessed some project management server in the data center. And once they're in the project management server, they were able to hop onto the point of sale terminal.
Because they're in the soft Chewy center.
They're in the soft Chewy center. And so I think it's the days of having networks that are wide open are gone. You have to go implement, no matter wired or wireless, you have to ensure you're authenticating, you know what it is or who is connecting into the network, and you have to build this metadata.
It's weird. I've been hearing this for years. Like, I've looked at SAML and SSO servers, and, you know, I've been working for financial institutions who wanted to be able to authenticate every step through the network, and that's just not been possible before.
They all authenticate into the application. The network never authenticates, right? The thing that was needed was 802.1x. You may have heard of it, .1x.
Yeah.
We use .1x in Wi-Fi. When you do WPA2 Enterprise, you're using 802.1x. Wired has .1x, but nobody uses it because it was inconvenient. It was too hard to go upgrade.
I was just going to say,
whatever.
It was too much of a pain in the rear end.
Yeah, it was too much
there
of a pain.
There's a litany of faults and flaws in 802. Yeah. Yeah. Operating system support was...
And a firewall is not the answer either, right? Firewalls are deep inside the network. The device and the threat is already in by the time it gets to the firewall. So you have to protect the port, the entry point where the threat actually exists. Yeah. And we used to call this network access control. It's a bad word now in the industry. But it is, you have to, I don't think it's acceptable anymore to leave ports open. And what we are trying to do in ClearPass is try to profile the ports that are open and then give you a sense of what is out there. And then if you take that and correlate that with other elements inside the database, then you can get some security insights and say, this point-of-sale terminal has no business talking to this project management server.
Right.
Right?
So, okay, that's actually a good segue to a point I want to come back to.
Yeah.
We brought up the notion of machine learning earlier.
Yeah.
Now, that is a growing media buzzword. Oh, yeah. We do machine learning.
Yeah.
Can you describe for us what that is and what that really means so that people can be forewarned when machine learning is getting thrown around, like SDN got thrown around and now you can't trust that term anymore because it doesn't have any real foundation or firmness to it. What is machine learning really, and how are you guys using it in the analytics engine?
Yeah, so machine learning is, let me describe by talking about something we do in networking a lot, which is we set thresholds for traps and, you know,
all sorts of things.
All sorts of things, right? So we say, okay, if something exceeds 80%, then send me an alert. If utilization on a link exceeds 80%, send me an alert.
Sure.
Now, that threshold may have been appropriate for a point in time, but may not be appropriate today. Maybe 20% was a threshold long time ago. Maybe the threshold needs to be 50% now. what machine learning allows you to do is to intelligently select the threshold by looking at data and analyzing what's the best threshold to actually put out there.
It's always computing a new baseline.
It's computing a new baseline, and it's applying algorithms to actually go do that, right? And in the past, we didn't do that. We used to just accept that, okay, I'm going to just set a threshold. I don't know if it's the right thing. It's, you know, it's just a guess. And if it exceeds, I'm going to go look at it if it's a real problem or not.
Yeah.
Right? And soon you get into the world of false positives.
And I'm smirking for that reason. Yeah, the false positives are there to ignore. One of these days, I'm going to fix that stupid thing. Yeah. And in the meantime, I'm just going to ignore
you
all
the over-alerted,
it's useless data.
Yeah. You get over-alerted, right? And that's not that interesting. What machine learning does is really extract, really, when is there a problem, by running very sophisticated algorithms. Another way to describe it, the thresholding world used to be a world of arithmetic. The machine learning world is a world of calculus. We're applying much more intelligent, sophisticated algorithms.
In other words, simple mathematics, I exceeded something, you know, very obvious, versus right. Now we're trying to figure out trends and do a long-term analysis
right.
on this. To
but
come
it's also
up
you're doing curve fitting, right? You're like, maybe this is a quadratic, maybe this is a cuboid function. I'm going to do a derivative on it and then examine how the trends are actually flowing. What's the slope of that thing? Mm-hmm. We have to go back to calculus,
yes.
Literally, right?
And but there's self-learning. Like you sort of said, the machine learning just works it out. It does. It's self-learning.
Yeah.
Comes back to this, did you know which question you want to ask? The machine learning algorithms, with calculus, cuboids, quadratics, It doesn't really matter. It analyzes the data flow and self-learns what it needs to set the threshold at. You don't have to tell it.
Yeah, that's what we call deep learning. I think the first phase of machine learning is just feature extraction, which is the application of calculus.
Okay.
I think the next step is really deep learning, what you're just talking about.
Which calculus to use.
Which calculus to use and maybe invent its own calculus along the way, right? Saying, hey, this particular trend that I'm seeing, it's an equation that I've not seen before, but this might be the better equation to use for this particular situation, right? And you know, there's a lot of very interesting work going on, advanced work going on in, take self-driving cars. There's a lot of this kind of technology going in there. You talk about...
Because you can't program in every conceivable situation that the self-driving car is going to... It has to have an ability to learn and gain knowledge to react to the future, whatever that might be.
That's right. And it can't also always rely on the compute algorithm running in the cloud. Mm. You need it to be autonomous. You need it to run, no matter whether you have network connection or not.
So you need to be able to run.
Yeah.
Network is infinitely complex in some ways because... Yeah. The interactions happening in the network aren't controlled.
That's right.
So you don't know what combination of laptops, tablets, and smartphones are going to be connected to your. So you have to be able to say the it's an unbound problem space, is what they say.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, we took machine learning and applied it to a simple problem of channel planning in wireless. Hmm. Right. You have to pick a channel. You have to pick a power level to operate every access point at.
And the more access points you have, the more complex that problem
more
is.
More complex that problem
the more noise
is.
Noise in your RF space, et cetera.
And the channel plans themselves are changing, right? We used to only plan for 20 megahertz channels. Then it became 40 megahertz channels, 80 megahertz, and there's any combination thereof, right? So there's infinite channel combinations out there. And humans can't keep it straight in their head anymore. It's just not possible. And so you have to rely now on machines to help you with this. And fortunately, the mathematics is there. The compute is there. So we just need to get the data to those machines so they can crunch on it and then give us the results so we can apply that in real time.
So what we're saying here as far as machine learning, it's not just a buzzword that you chose because it's trendy these days. You're actually doing some machine learning in the analytics engine and applying it to specific use cases. It's not, you know, some magical thing where Skynet's going to pop out. You're taking the technique to specific problems.
That's right.
That the analytics engine's got data it can do something with.
That's right.
Okay, right.
That's exactly right. And the self-tuning concept that we talked about is, I mean, you'll hear the word artificial intelligence uttered a lot over the next decade, I think, in addition to machine learning, deep learning, and so on. IBM Watson, I mean, if you've seen it play Jeopardy, all about machine learning. That's real stuff that's happening out there. And there's some very real results coming out of it. And I think that technology as a base, if you're a computer science graduate in school today, it's something you should be learning about. So you can apply to no matter what field you're going to get into, this is going to play a big role, I think.
Now, you gave us a use case of channel planning. Are there other use cases that are either there or that you're thinking about?
So channel planning is the first one. The other one is because we really want to get to a self-tuning Wi-Fi environment as quickly as possible, as smartly as possible.
Self-tuning and constantly reacting to changing RF.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And stably, right? We don't want the network to keep bouncing between one state and another. Mm. You just want it to settle down. The other one is insights. As I talked about the network, we talked about Aruba Clarity today, which is this ability to go understand the user experience. And that we have to really look at all the different variables that affect user experience and then pinpoint exactly where the problems. I'm seeing problems in DNS round trip times to this particular DNS server. Right, I need to be able to extract that particular trend out of a mountain of data. Right, that's another very real problem that we are applying machine learning algorithms to.
Picking out the pieces of a transaction that are causing bad user experience, bad going user back to experience. That again.
And then looking at it in the aggregate across all transactions.
It's so easy to say, just pick out the fact that DNS is performing slowly. But you're also talking about terabytes of captured metadata.
That's right.
Right. So it's not just...
I mean, we used to do single transaction troubleshooting. You put a sniffer in there. You'll pick out the packets and go, this header is misformatted or, I'm seeing some bad traffic going on or whatever.
But you probably spend 5 days getting to the point where you're packet capturing.
That's right.
Does Internet of Things help me here? In other words, is there data coming out of IoT networks that's interesting to an analytics engine?
Very. Very interesting. And again, that is affecting our physical environment, actually. The questions that a mall owner was asking me was, I spend an inordinate amount of money on keeping the environmental controls inside a mall. And I run the AC systems all the time, whether the mall is occupied or not. And so he's like, if you can tell me what the population density is and where the population density is, I may be able to modulate where I'm going to cool my mall and where I'm going to choose not to use as much AC. That's real savings for me in terms of utility bills. And I was like, okay, we can give you location data and we can give you information on how you tune your thermostats.
Because I know where the human beings are that need the environmental control. Now you can make intelligent decisions about, I see.
And the thing is the thermostat. It's on the network. I'm controlling the thermostat based on information that's coming.
It's a threshold problem because you set the temperature in an area and a guy goes out there with a rate flow meter, holds it up under the vent, and it blows over it.
Yeah.
And that's it. Yeah. Set. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You can't, but you could reprogram, add in actuators and start to change the flow.
The thresholds could be different, right? When nobody is there, I'll take it down to 56 degrees.
Yes.
But when people are there, I want it up at 68 degrees, for example, right? But I can't just set it at 68 and say if it goes plus or minus 2, I'm going to kick in my AC system, right?
Do I have to have an all Aruba network to make this happen?
For the insight piece, yes. We are, and I'll tell you why. It's fundamentally the extraction of metadata needs to be instrumented in the access points, and you have to do it proactively, thoughtfully. It is not about pushing packets. If you want to push Wi-Fi packets, you can go to anyone, right? Everybody will claim that they can push Wi-Fi packets, and they probably do a decent job at it. But if you want to now learn about the packets, what happened to it, who did it come from, the device, the metadata, as we talked about, we've instrumented the access point to extract the metadata, put it in an analytics engine so you can ask these questions. And that's why I said you need an Aruba access point to do that.
Did you ever imagine back in, when did you say you started?
2002.
Do you ever think that your access point would be a packet sniffer?
No. I did not. A sensor, actually, is what we call it, right? It's a sensor of everything that's actually happening and then extracting metadata. Absolutely not. We were trying to establish ourselves. Wi-Fi was not very good in the enterprise back then. We were just saying, hey, let's just...
We were lucky if we could get connected.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I remember in 1998 playing with a digital 1 meg distributed spectrum Wi-Fi thing, and it was miserable.
Yeah.
Right? It was fine, and we worked. But it was so slow and, whatever. But just being connected was a miracle, and we were so grateful for that. But 10 years later, it's, being connected is assumed, and it's about finding the next level.
And it's accelerating. The fun part about it is all these, the more we build out the infrastructure, the more this new requirements are coming to the fore, right? And to us, it's exciting. As technologists, we get to solve new problems, new exciting problems. And going back to the original purpose of this business insight, the line that you said, which is a Dilbertian line, right? I never expected network engineers to be in the business of answering these kinds of questions, right? I always thought we were relegated to the basement, pushing packets. But now we are up there, man. We are in the top floor.
Keep them in the dark in the basement. Throw a piece of pizza down there once in a while. You don't want to talk to them. You don't want to talk to them.
Exactly.
As long as the network's fine, leave them alone.
Yeah. I mean, I must say, I've been on a line for the last year that the network can only get dumber and that everything's going to be done in an overlay. And you've given me some hope that the actual network itself might become smart enough to actually participate, because we haven't seen the devices normally iterate fast enough to have the features to collect data and metadata. And or I didn't believe that most networking vendors would be able to build machine learning software anytime soon. So to come here and find you've already done it is like, oh, hang on. It's closer than I think. The future is not as far away as
it is. Not as far away. We're not there yet, I don't think, but we are on the journey, and I think we're going to get there sooner or later. I mean, it's just, you need to just take a step up and sniff around and see what else people are doing. And the self-driving car really inspired me. I was like, man, if they can put a car that doesn't need a driver, I should be able to do something on the network.
Well, what's the roadmap then? Can you give us some vision?
Yeah, I mean, we just released, for example, one of the things, location, I think, is going to play a very big role in the network. Mm-hmm. And the network is going to do things beyond pushing packets. Of course, it has to push packets, but it is going to, by virtue of location, allow you to interact with the physical environment around you and with people around you. I'll tell you one thing we just released that got me super excited. This morning, we talked about location sharing. And the idea is that instead of wayfinding your way within a facility, which we talked about going from point A to point B, incredibly useful when you are in a new building and you want to find a conference room. You can go from the front door to a conference room yourself. But then we released this idea of, okay, find a friend, right? We're used to find a friend using GPS, but not indoors. And at a convention like this, right, finding my friends was non-trivial.
That's just in the breakfast room. Yeah. room is 350 meters long.
I got to breakfast first this morning. I took a picture from where I was sitting and mailed it to him so he'd have an easier time figuring out where I was, because it's so big.
Exactly. And I hadn't envisioned the power of this thing, to be honest with you, until we released it. And as soon as we released it this morning, the number of requests I've got for location sharing just is inspiring, to say the least. It's like, wow, so many people. And I could already start to think about new features, right? I wanted to subscribe to a group.
And again, for the audience, what we're talking about here is that in the Atmosphere 2016 app, live from the stage, location sharing was enabled, which I turned my feature on and shared it with Greg so that he could see on his app with a little blue dot where I physically was located at the venue here.
And it did work?
Yes.
Yeah.
Scarily well.
Yes.
That's right. You knew I was in the middle of the front of the auditorium, about two rows back from the stage where the keynote was given.
Yeah. It's a delightful experience, actually.
Yeah.
Once you get past that scary part, you go, hey, this is fantastic. Yeah. I found Ozer, who's a colleague here, a couple of times already. I might be stalking him at this point. I'm not sure. But I can imagine now universities, right? Most of a lot of university customers said, you have no idea how powerful this is going to be at a university campus, where people are trying to find their friends literally so they can do a study session together. Or late at night, campus safety. I'm walking, there's so many incidents of rapes and stuff like that late at night. So if you're a student and you're worried about your campus safety, you can share your location with the security department and say, hey, this is where I am, track me.
Incident in action.
So there's a lot of applications that you can get for this, right? And again, I never thought a network would do that, but it does now. And I think using machine learning, using the location techniques, there's a lot of new things that we can bring beyond just providing a great user experience and providing a secure user experience.
So people should know that we recorded a podcast with Julia Farina, who's the head of that Meridian Apps team. Mm-hmm. So if people are interested in hearing more about the details there, we talked a little bit about the technology and some of the business values. So people should listen to that. It's titled Powering Up Indoor Location-Based Service with Aruba Meridian.
It'll be on our Priority Queue channel.
That's correct. Yep.
More vision, more the location sharing. I mean, that's here today. You got some long-term stuff.
So we're going to build on it, right? I mean, immediately I got feature requests, and we learned from customers, right? We put this thing out there. We learned, hey, it'll be great to form location groups. So I can take a group of people and share location, not just individual one-on-one, but within a group. It's a trusted group, and we all want to know where all of us are in a group, for example, right? The other flip side of it is I want to share my location with you only for a period of time until I meet you. After that, I want to stop sharing. So I can tell you there's things like that have popped up, right? So that's in the context of location. In the context of ClearPass, we talked about multi-factor authentication. And, we've been using passwords in the network authentication realm for a long time now. And it's mainly passwords in Active Directory. that we're using to log into the domain, Windows domain. And the biggest pain in a mobile device kind of world is every 3 months or 6 months, you're asked to change your password. And when you change your password, you got to change it on every device.
Yep.
And every application that uses email and Skype for Business and everything else that you use, it's a pain in the neck.
It's comically untenable at this point.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's getting so tiring, right? So we want. How do you solve that problem? How do you get away from that and yet create a more secure kind of model? And multi-factor authentication is something that will come to the rescue, and we just think MFA is a technology that will enable network authentication in the future.
Because you've got this phone in your pocket that you can do all kinds of authentication techniques with.
With, exactly.
So such as Touch ID on an iPhone.
Or use a photograph as something you know to authenticate you into the network.
That's unique, something you have and you've shared with the system before.
Correct.
You can prove it's you because you just share that photo again.
A photo is pretty unique.
Exactly.
Yes.
A photo that you took, by the way.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
A photo that you took and uploaded to the system.
And you picked the photograph, so nobody else knows. I'm not guessing a random set of characters and brute forcing it. How do I know how to guess your photograph? There's just no way.
Mm.
And applying it on a contextual basis, but I think the underlying framework is what is even more exciting to me. We've solved the multi-factor authentication problem, and I think we're going to extend it. But in the process of solving that problem, we invented this feature called ClearPass Extensions, which was the ability for a network engineer, a software engineer, to write a piece of code that can integrate with any software service out there and affect action on the network. And this is, think of it like a little container or a sandbox that you can do whatever it is, develop your own feature on. In networking, that's like unheard of, right? We wait for vendors to release their code. We then qualify this code in our labs.
We sit down in meetings.
And then we roll it out over 18 months and then freeze it for 36 months. So innovation, be damned, I'm going to be stable forever, right?
Yeah.
So I think this is exciting to me because now we can innovate without disturbing the underlying stable fabric that we've built.
I think there's two things in that. I think you can start building apps on that and trialing them and seeing if, as well as third parties, so customers themselves or other vendors can start participating in your ecosystem.
Yeah.
And it's sort of taking the bits of open source that sort of worked and bringing them into your platform.
And it's really about solving real world problems.
Mm.
I mean, there's a lot of buzzwords out there, as you guys say, and I'm as cynical as you guys are or anybody is, right? When you say open source, machine learning, deep learning, these are all great buzzwords, SDN. The ultimate question is, what problem do you have and how can I help you to solve it?
Mm.
Right? As long as we focus on that, life is much better.
Mm.
And so we'll give you the tools to go do that. That's basically been our mission at Aruba. And to do that better, what we've found is the network architecture that we've built over the decades, right? We closely couple the control, the management, and the data plane in a single box, an embedded box, jammed it all together, called it Aruba OS 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, or Cisco IOS, whatever. Mm-hmm. And what we have done is we've consumed it, as I said earlier, as a monolithic piece of code. And we qualify it, test the hell out of it in our lab, do a pilot, iron the bugs out, and then we freeze it until the next refresh, basically. And that, I think, is blocked and slowed innovation in a very big way in the networking industry. And what we've had to do is fundamentally change how we approach network software architecture by basically saying the job of pushing packets is critical, it's important. Let's not disturb that. That needs to happen no matter what. That's the autonomous part of the self-driving network.
Mm-hmm.
But the intelligence that drives packet pushing can be extracted out. And it can run off-board. It doesn't need to run inside a router or a controller or an access point.
Which makes it easier to innovate without impacting the fundamental job of pushing packets.
That's right. That's right. And so that separation of this control plane intelligence from the data plane, I think, is fundamentally important. And that's basically what we're doing at Aruba, is to start to extract that out.
And that's going to be gradual. That's not overnight. You're not going to achieve that.
No,
because
you have a monolithic architecture still.
Yeah. Everybody has a monolithic architecture still. No matter what people claim, we are still building boxes, embedded systems, basically.
Yeah.
And no matter what term you give it, right? And so going from there to this disaggregated system that allows you to add more intelligence is the journey we are on. And I think we announced something today, Aruba OS 8.0, which will serve as a first step for us. But I think it's a journey that we're going to be on over a longer period of time.
I think so. You don't change those systems And those years of reliability improve. You know, you need to make money today.
That's right.
It's not like you can stop and say, hey, we need to change everything. Just hang on, we'll stop. Hang on for a year or two.
I can't say, here's a cool feature, but I can't push back it.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of it.
So, Katie, I want to go back to something you were saying a moment ago. You said, well, everybody's really running monolithic, but yet we know that there's a number of open source operating systems that are coming up. The open networking model tends to be more modular now with what we're seeing. And I know HP has got the OpenSwitch project. Mm-hmm. Is that interesting to Aruba? Is there a tie
in
there?
Yeah. I mean, so look, in data center technology, what's happening is the private data centers are getting smaller. The public data centers are getting much bigger. And they're operating at web scale. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots and lots of machines, servers, storage devices, networks. And what we're hearing from customers is that they want to disaggregate the software layer from the hardware layer.
So buy my box, whatever it is, and I'll put whatever software on it that I want to.
That's right. And not just that, I want to be able to write the intelligence, back to our earlier point, on top of the software.
Mm.
So they're not even that interested, frankly, in the network operating system as how they can control it.
Because the network operating system part, the pushing packets part, is kind of table stakes.
It's table stakes,
Certain control protocols are just taken for granted. It's BGP or it's whatever it is.
Yeah. In a data center, it is actually very simple. It's BGP and potentially some multi-link layer 2 capability, right?
Yeah.
Well, and VXLAN, potentially.
Sure.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated. Most of those web-scale data centers, 95% of the flows follow the IP routing path, and 5% of them are programmed individually. So the critical flows.
That's right.
So, but what they do for that is they use custom apps.
Correct.
And even the BGP is often highly customized.
Correct.
They want the ability to be able to put their own apps onto the operating system. And as you say, operating system is table stakes. Packet forwarding should happen at wire speed.
And where we're getting to with OpenSwitch is now some modularity where you're able to set up an interface that allows you to manage this thing in whatever way.
That is exactly correct. So you can write your own BGP if you want and run it on OpenSwitch and use it in your switch, right? And we have people working on that. And that's the value of being open source is you end up getting the power of a much larger developer team than you can ever hope for as a vendor, right? I mean, we have a developer team that's smart, that's contributing to the OpenSwitch project, but we have a community now that's forming with these Web 2.0 guys, web-scale guys. We have silicon vendors that are very interested. Part of the problem, unknown problem, frankly, in the industry, is there's a limited supply of silicon vendors simply because there's not enough money to port my operating system to a new silicon vendor. Mm-hmm. But if there's a disaggregated operating system in the middle, the silicon vendor, next-generation silicon vendor, can innovate on silicon and say, here is the OpenSwitch port. So I don't have to go do the port myself. I just consume the OpenSwitch port, the hardware abstraction, and use the new switch.
No matter what the underlying silicon is.
No matter what the underlying silicon is. So it really gives you a lot more degrees of freedom in how you can innovate.
So are we going to see Aruba OS and OpenSwitch be related in some way? Someday?
Someday. Not right now. I think that the initial focus for OpenSwitch is really on data center switching, which is where the requirements are coming from. But the principles are definitely adaptable. Mm. And it's something that we want to bring into other operating systems, including Aruba OS.
So in the same way that it took Aruba 12 years to get to this point, 14 years to get to this point, and the operating system stable and with features, OpenSwitch is going to have to go through that cycle. It won't take 14 years, but it's certainly not going to happen in a year or two.
It will. We're aiming for a first customership of that, if you will, 1.0 of that. Not even, I shouldn't say first customership because it's a community project. Mm. So 1.0 of that is June or July is what we're expecting.
Yeah.
And then iterate from there. But I think the pace of iteration will be very quick because the developer teams that are on it are pretty significant and diverse. So everyone has their own interests in keeping the code base stable because they want the apps ultimately to run stable.
I guess the flip side is that OpenSwitch doesn't have to do the BGP.
That's right.
It's the actual. I've got to keep that in mind, right? You can still go and get Bird and Quagga if you want BGP. And,
correct.
You know, it's not like you're trying to bundle all those in. OpenSwitch is literally just the operating system.
Just the operating system part.
The forwarding plane.
That's right. Mm. That's right. And we have a silicon vendor, very interesting silicon vendor that wants to build programmable switches. It is it's a pretty radical concept. You'll hear about this more and more. But, you know, as a networking vendor, for me to adopt someone like that, it's a pretty significant commitment. I have to go hive off 20, 30 developers
yes.
to go write the drivers to make it work on there. Mm. It's, I cannot afford to because I have no money coming in.
Mm.
But if they can give me a port to OpenSwitch, it's very easy for me to embed them into my flow and take them to market.
Well, there's multiple vendors already. You know, today everybody's putting their weight behind Broadcom. But Cavium, XPliant, you've got Intel with their Fulcrum chipset, you've got Marvell.
Yeah.
You know, we need that flexibility because there's a lot of innovation we can bring into the silicon. We don't often talk about silicon these days because speeds and feeds is kind of a solved problem. Having a range of CPUs actually gives you the ability to do stuff.
Speeds and feeds are kind of a solved problem. Programmability is not.
No.
Mm-hmm. And that's why they're application-specific integrated circuits.
Yeah.
That's right. And we want to make them programmable and more general purpose.
Yeah, instead of application-specific.
That's right.
Well, Kirti, I know we're catching you at the end of a long day where I suspect you've been talking pretty much all day.
Yes. My throat is about to give up.
I'm sure. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us on Packet Pushers this week. And are you social? Do you have Twitter, blog?
Yes, I have a Twitter handle. It's at Kirti Melkote, KeertiMelkote.
And are you a blogger too by any chance? Or
I blog occasionally.
Okay,
I'm not. I don't get enough time. I would love to blog more if I
can. You're too busy speaking, of
course.
Well, thanks once again for coming on Packet Pushers today. And to those folks that are listening, anything that that Kirti talked about here, we have three other shows that we recorded with Aruba folks that are published on the Priority Queue channel. And you can find out more about just about anything that he talked about in and amongst those other three shows. That is it for this edition of the Packet Pushers Weekly Show. We thank Aruba, our sponsor today. If you're not already subscribed to Priority Queue or the Fat Pipe, you can find these other Aruba shows at packetpushers.net, and you'll hear more technical detail about what Aruba is offering. If you like this show, you can find many more technical podcasts for IT engineers at packetpushers.net, and please tell your friends about the show. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.